If you swallow.
They don't police it, but the language, I guess, now does talk about allowing them to consume.
Jeez.
A major way.
You know, with presidents, you have to.
That's pretty good for a moment sector guy.
Okay, I'm going to call to order this February 24th meeting of the Higher Ed Subcommittee of the House Education Committee. Welcome to all of you. Just to begin, a couple of housekeeping things. Please turn off your cell phones. Somehow make them silent. And also, we have adopted a protocol here that if you're coming up to address us, you only need to address the co-chair who holds the gavel, and today that's my honor. With that, I am going to open a work session on a couple of bills, and then we'll go into our information hearing, where we have the honor of hearing from a number of our university presidents here. So I'm going to start by opening a work session on House Bill 2728. And this is a bill that we had a public hearing on last week, having to do with creating additional incentives for people signing on to our Oregon 529 college savings accounts. We had a good hearing on it last week, but we have some amendments that we'd like you to entertain. And I would invite up Rep. Reed, who's the submitter of those amendments, and he can explain to us what they are and what they're trying to do.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. Although I recognize that with the release of the census numbers yesterday, these district numbers are relatively meaningless these days, so we'll see how that goes. Happy that you have a chance to look at the Dash 1 amendments for House Bill 2728. As you recall, this seeks to allow taxpayers the opportunity to direct their refunds to 529 programs for college savings. When we heard the bill before your committee last, we uncovered some needed changes to make the intended effect actually take place, and we're fortunate to have the good assistance of the Revenue Department and the 529 program. Michael Parker, the Executive Director, is here, and with your indulgence, I would turn over to him to describe the actual effect and how they believe that things will work smoothly.
Great, thank you. For the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did craft some amendments that DOR has approved, and the amendments are fairly simple. They really allow the bill to be much more easily administered, I think, by the Department of Revenue. You know, a couple of them allowing the deduction or the contribution from your refund to be $25 or greater to allow for our rules of $25 as our minimum deposit. And then just a couple other rules as far as the election to contribute a refund under section of this section, it can't be revoked or changed. So once you make that election, it has to stay with that. And then making sure that the taxpayer, if you think your refund is going to be a certain amount and ends up being lower than that amount, then this election would be off and nothing would be deposited into the account. So we're trying to make it easier for revenue to administer the bill. And again, we have worked out the fiscal impact to this bill where, you know, there are some IT resources that revenue has to incur to make this happen, and we have agreed to work on a revenue transfer from the 529 network directly over to cover those fiscal impacts that revenue would incur in this process as a one-time setup cost. So with these amendments, I think both a revenue and the 529 plan can make this bill a work as the amendments state.
And Mr. Chair, one other note I neglected to mention on the second page of the amendments in line 3, you'll note that the effective date changes to 2012. I'm not thrilled with that idea, but I recognize that the 529 network and the Revenue Department have some work to do to get it all set. So we'd be accepting of that change as well.
Okay. Anyone have questions of either of our witnesses? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Rep. Johnson, would you like to move
this? Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated 223-11 to House Bill, 2728.
Okay, any discussion, committee? Anyone have any objection to our adopting these amendments? Mm-hmm. Seeing none, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted. We can't do any more with this bill at this time because we are still waiting for a fiscal analysis of the impact of this bill. As soon as we get that back, we'll schedule a work hearing and move it along, presumably. Thank you. Okay. Yes. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2728. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2353. House Bill 2353 is the bill related to the National Career Readiness Certificate Program. And we had a very good public hearing on it a couple of weeks ago. But we do have a couple of amendments that you're being asked to consider. The Dash 1 amendments have to do with who is eligible for the program. And Anna, do you want to say anything about it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Dash 1 amendments limits the services of the program to Oregon residents and employees of Oregon businesses. Thank you.
Okay. And we have Krista from the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. If any of you have any questions about this, this has to do with people who are resident in Oregon but work in another state, or actually the reverse. Yes, people who live in another state but work in Oregon. Krista? If you could just introduce yourself, Krista.
Chair Dambrough, members of the committee, my name is Krista Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Commissioner, Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. It's the reverse of what you just said. The businesses are located in Oregon, and it would be for one of their employees that lives across the state line.
Right. And the purpose is that this is a program that Oregon businesses want to take advantage of. Right?
They do, and many are taking advantages of this. It's helping with, it's a program that helps with people that want to advance, look at their skills, see where they are, see what kinds of skill gaps they have and what they can do for further training. And it's also a program we're using extensively across the state when somebody is laid off, for them to know what their own skills are and to start doing career search and making decisions about what they might want to do next.
Okay, anybody have any questions about the Dash 1s? Okay, thank you, Krista. Then I would entertain a motion related to them.
Mr. Chair, I move that we would adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2353. Is that correct? Okay.
Okay. Rep. Johnson has moved that we adopt these amendments. Anybody have any problems with that? Okay. Seeing no objection, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted. There are Dash 2s. And they're somewhere in the pile. And this, Anna, why don't you explain these to us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2353 expands the NCERC services to provide information to school districts, education school service districts, community colleges, and community college service networks about NCERC and assessments, instruction, and remedial training. It directs school districts, education service districts, community colleges, and community college service districts to report and summarize the participation and enrollment rate of students using these services in the most recent academic year to the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development.
Do you have the Dash 2s there? I don't seem to have them.
It's at the same page.
They're
on the same page.
Yeah.
If you can see it.
Okay. Yeah, it's also on the SMS.
Oh.
Sure. Great. So, yes, you'll recall this came up during the public hearing. You know, part of the program is that there'll be an annual report from the CCWD regarding utilization of the Career Readiness Certificate. And what this asks them to do is also report on how the NCERC is being utilized in our high schools and colleges to see how they're being integrated into those programs, so that many people have an interest in knowing how our students are stacking up against students in other parts of the country. And apparently some of the districts are actually looking at requiring a CRC level of silver for all their graduates. And so just to incentivize those kinds of utilizations of the NCRC. Anybody have any questions about it?
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2353.
Okay. Everyone okay with that? All right. Seeing no objection, the Dash 2 amendments are adopted. We have a minimal fiscal on the Dash 2s. We've not yet received a fiscal on the Dash 1. We expect that to be equally minimal, but we can't vote on this bill today. We'll do that next week, hopefully. Okay, so I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2353, and we will move on to what? 3042. Okay, so I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3042, and tell us about this one, Anna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3042 stipulates that tuition and fees collected by food and beverage career programs for courses relating to the consumption and possession of alcohol is not considered sale of alcoholic beverage, allows educational programs to serve alcoholic beverages to students between 18 and 20 years of age, and allows for the possession or consumption of alcohol under the supervision of the educational provider for training purposes, permits property owners to allow persons between ages 18 and 20 that possess and consume alcohol for educational purposes to remain on the property, becomes operative September 2nd, 2011, and declares an emergency effective on passage. Thank you.
Okay. So we had a public hearing the other day on this bill. Rep. Lindsay could not be with us on that day, and I know he has some concerns about it. And so would you like to share those, Rep. Lindsay?
Correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, by the way. I received all of the information from the last hearing. I've reviewed that thoroughly. I've also done some research in what other states do, and the majority of other states, what they do is they do what's called a sip and spit rule, or in other words, taste but not consume. And I would think that I'd prefer that method here. Some of the states that have done that are Florida, Missouri, Colorado, I believe it was Mississippi, and I'm happy to give those to you formally if you'd like as well. So I actually, I move to amend, or do we have to open up the work session?
We have opened the work session,
okay.
but we have to do amendments through legislative council, et cetera.
Actually, Actually, we can. I can do a specific amendment, and that's what I'm moving to do, is to do a specific amendment, and I'll state that now. So I move to, and that's pursuant to the rules here. I'm happy to show them to you if you'd like, but I move to, and let me just get this on the record, I move to amend House Bill 3042 by replacing each reference of, quote, possess and consume, close quote, to, quote, taste but not consume, close quote, including mirror changes for verb tenses.
Okay. Rep. Lindsay has made that amendment. Let me say that my own preference would actually be that rather than adopt those amendments at this point, that we consult with Representative Olson, who submitted the original bill, and he can talk to some of the stakeholders, and perhaps, you know, so we can see if that's the best language. That I understand your concern, and I think it's an important concern, but whether or not that specific language is the best way to do it, I'm not sure.
Okay.
So I would actually urge us not to pass that at this time.
Could I ask a question, Mr. Chair? I do want to comment on that proposal or that motion to amend. I'm a little confused in process right now since we haven't done this. Are you entertaining that motion? Have you just opened up discussion on that motion?
Well, we're in work session, and the motion has been made, and so I'm happy to have discussion of it.
Would we need a second for the purposes of discussion, or...?
We don't
need
a second.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Maybe I can clarify that question, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to remove my motion if you would like to not entertain a motion to pass it and come back at a later time to consider those informally.
I would appreciate that.
Okay.
But still, I would be interested in hearing if there's any reaction to the concept.
Sure.
So that we can give some direction to the stakeholders.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just a couple things, because I am one of the sponsors on this bill, and that motion is kind of new to me in this context. So I would... First of all, I think it's very important to have Representative Olson in on this conversation also. And I'm not really that opposed if that is workable language. It makes sense, and that's been the longstanding policy of Lynn Benton Community College, in particular, a sip and spit policy.
For the
and
students
so
above 21.
For the students below 21, yes, sip and spit. Yes, 21, correct. And so I don't think that that's a significant departure for them, but I do think it would be prudent of us to also chat with the university and look into this a little more, opposed to just at this moment, which was what I was going to weigh in when I thought you opened up for discussion.
Thank you. Rep. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate Representative Lindsay's thorough examination of the bill, and... A couple of words that jumped out to me as we were just reading the summary. One would be serve, and the other would be consumption. And I think that those could be interpreted in some different ways. And I guess if our intent is to simply make a product, if the intent of the bill is to simply make the product available for the students to get a better understanding of the actual taste and so forth and so on, I guess my feeling is that the language that Representative Lindsay is suggesting would help to focus that, and I don't think it would remove the intent of the bill, just to make it available. But I guess I am concerned by language like serving, which could be a pretty broad-based action. You know, you could serve a little or serve a lot. And consumption. Consumption is hard to quantify as well. So those words kind of leap off the page to me. Now, I appreciate your thoroughness in bringing those to our attention. So I guess I, too, would be interested in drawing Representative Olson into the discussion and seeing if that conveys the intent that he was trying to accomplish in this legislation.
Great. Representative Hoyle?
I also am interested in hearing from the stakeholders about what the purpose is, what they need, and how, because as you brought this bill forward, and I think there was a fair amount of work that went into finding out what exactly was needed to make sure that we can offer the best programs possible for our culinary arts students. And I also think as a general rule, although, you know, rules are tools, are used tools to get the job done, and although we are able to do things like bring up motions, it is really important, I think, that we communicate and get all stakeholders involved in every part of the process. So I appreciate that you took your amendment off the table and that we'll be able to hear from the stakeholders.
Okay. Great. Okay, I'm going to close this work session then on House Bill, which one was this? 3042. It'll come back to us next week and since then. Okay, now I am going to open our informational meeting, which is a continuation of the overview of Oregon universities. And we're going to hear from three university presidents. I won't speak to the order in which they're appearing, that's indicative of anything, but we are beginning with President LaRiviere, then we'll have President Ray, and then President Bivel. You can do your own analysis of that order.
Coin flip.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Richard LaRiviere, the president of the University of Oregon. I want to thank the co-chairs and the members for the committee for this opportunity. Thank you for having us. It's been my pleasure to meet with each of you and many of your colleagues in the course of my first 20 months here. And I've been impressed with your knowledge of the challenges and the opportunities that are facing us. I have had an enormous amount of fun as the president of the University of Oregon, not just going to football games. In fact, that's really not been the most fun. The most fun has been getting to know the people who care passionately about higher education in this state. And I came to the university because of the excellence of the faculty and the power of public universities to change lives. I've had mine changed by a public university, and I brought someone with me today who's having his life changed by University of Oregon. Zachary Taylor is a junior from Cottage Grove who's studying public policy. He's at the University of Oregon at no cost to him or his family for tuition and fees because he is a participant in our Pathway Oregon program. Pathway Oregon ensures that academically qualified Pell Grant eligible Oregonians will have all of their tuition and all of their fees paid with a combination of Pell Grants, university, and other financial aid resources. Pathway makes sure that any qualified Oregonian entering as a freshman has zero unmet financial need for tuition and fees. And if you would indulge me, I'd like Zach to take just a minute of your time to tell you a bit of his story at the University of Oregon. Zach?
Thank you, President LaRiviere. I'd also like to thank Co-Chair Dembro and the entire committee for hearing my testimony.
Zach, you'll have to introduce yourself for us first.
Okay.
For the record.
My name is Zachary Taylor.
Thank you.
As I was saying, I think like all Pathway students, my opportunities have been limited, but my ambition has never faltered. From the time I was a young child, growing up in, you know, the rural community, Cottage Grove, my mother kind of always encouraged me, you know, to dream big and to shoot for the stars, you know, even though we lived on a very limited income. For me, Pathway Oregon has lifted the heavy burden of financial dependency and indebtedness that plague so many, you know, recently graduated students. It has just allowed me the opportunity to kind of uninhibitedly pursue my academic interests at the university. If the financial support is not enough, the amount of personal and academic support I've received from my advisors at the Pathway Oregon program has been just invaluable. Working closely with my Pathway advisor, she shared with me many opportunities. I just recently, this last term, was admitted to the National McNair Scholars Program. Through this program, I have kind of the ultimate goal of attaining a PhD. I think because of the Pathway Oregon program, graduate school, which, to me was so far off, is now, a very likely option. I think the support that I've received from my advisor has really, like I said, just been invaluable. I think so many students really take advantage of this program and of the advisors because we truly are students who, have shown academic merit but also need that financial support. Through my personal experiences, I've learned that independence is a very valuable quality to possess, but I also recognize that, I would never be able to achieve my full potential without the support and guidance of others. And through that, it kind of behooves me to seek out and acquire guidance any way and however I can. So thank you very much for hearing my testimony.
Thank you. Congratulations on the McNair Scholarship.
Thank you.
Very, quite an achievement.
We're proud of Zach. Well, let me take you just a brief minute to give you an overview of where the university is at the moment. We have about 23,400 students in our current enrollment. That's a University of Oregon record. Our incoming freshman GPA is 3.52. That's also a record for the university. University of Oregon confers about 28% of the degrees awarded by the Oregon University System institutions. Last year that was 3,800 bachelor's degrees. We confer about 26% of the Oregon University System's graduate degrees. Last year that was 1,272 degrees awarded at the University of Oregon. Our total projected revenues for the current fiscal year are just over $726 million. Our final state appropriation is projected to be $53.4 million, or 8% of our budget. It's 7% of our budget if you take out the one-time federal stimulus money. By the way, our final appropriation this year will be about $8 million less in real dollars than it was 20 years ago, just to put that in some context. Tuition and fees this year will cover 40% of our budget. Last year, our freshman retention rate was 88%. Our six-year graduation rate is 67-plus, almost 68%. Our applications for this fall are up by 25% from the previous year at this precise moment. And the last 2 years, we have broken the record in each of those years for the number of applications. So you can see that this is a pretty dramatic trend. But even with the increased demand, last year we admitted every single qualified Oregon student who applied, and we will do the same this fall. I'm very grateful for this committee's attention to the growing Latino population in Oregon. Like my colleagues across the system, we are increasing our efforts to get these students in the pipeline. We're doing a number of things because there's no single magic bullet that will address these matters. We are doing our best to speak to families as well as to the students. But the students are clearly the most fun. This coming Saturday, we're having a fairly large group of Latino high school students from Woodburn come to the campus to join an even larger group of African American students from Portland at a special event to introduce them to our campus. And while they're there, we're going to take them to the Stanford game on the president's nickel. So that would be great. That'll be great fun. We are giving you copies of the university's state legislative priorities and also a brochure that we have just prepared with updated data and analyses by one of our economists, Tim Dewey, who also produces our monthly index of economic indicators. I'm not going to take your time now to go through those documents, but I will say that, in my view, the University of Oregon is doing a job that the people of Oregon can be enormously proud of in terms of economic stimulation. We harnessed $58.5 million of state money last year and turned it into $2 billion in direct and indirect expenditures. In addition, beyond the $58.5 million, the rest comes from our faculty, who successfully win competitive grants at a per capita rate that is among the top in the nation. Just anecdotally, we're searching for a new vice president for research on our campus, and that means that we are looking at candidates who are among the most sophisticated in the world in terms of technology transfer and the development of research agendas at a university. And it has been wonderfully edifying to see how astonished they are at the rate of per capita generation of financial inputs for research, and more importantly, at the rate at which these discoveries are being commercialized and brought into the marketplace. I think we're in the top 20-something of universities in the country in that regard. Well, the university's economic footprint is big. It comes from friends, donors, corporations, and others who understand what it is that we're about and who recognize a great investment when they see it. But it's also important to understand that this impact extends well beyond our campus. Research partnerships like ONAMI, BEST, OTREC give us enormous opportunities to reach out throughout the state. The Loke Laboratories, which is one of our nanotech specialty labs, is a high-tech extension service that provides unique instrumentation not just to other universities but to companies. We had earlier this year a delegation led by the former mayor of Hillsborough who brought in prospective companies that were going to locate in his region, but they needed the equipment that we have uniquely at the University of Oregon, and that's exactly what we exist there for. We have graduates in virtually every school district in Oregon, and our graduate students teach science in Hermiston and the Umatilla-Moro Education Service District through federally funded grants. Our students are deeply embedded in local government throughout the state, and these students add capacity, particularly in rural communities. And because of our Sustainable Cities Year, we bring between 80 and 100,000 person hours per year to bear on the problems of specific municipalities. Last year, Gresham was the beneficiary of this remarkable effort. This year, Salem is.
Mr. President, yes. I'm going to have to ask you to come towards your conclusion so we can leave time for questions.
Sure.
I'm sure my colleagues have questions.
Well, my conclusion is really pretty simple. The University of Oregon is doing a superb job given the level of investment from the state. We've got some problems, however. In-state tuition has increased 241% in the last 20 years.
Wow.
It's gone up because of increased costs, but there have been remarkable efficiencies to counter those costs. The most dramatic change is the rate of disinvestment from the state subsidy. But in spite of that, we have managed to continue to provide the greatest amount of financial aid that we possibly can. We have Pathway Oregon programs and other kinds of programs that are targeted specifically at the lowest socioeconomic strata in our state to make available a world-class education to them. And the reason that I come to work every day is seated right here. This is what we're here for. That's what you're here for, too, and I know that. We are not here to complain We are not here to lament the fact that tuition has gone up because of the diminution of state investment. We are where we are. I understand better than most people the pressures that this budget is under and that you are under as a result. But I'm confident that if we work together, we can solve many of the problems that confront us, and we can make room for lots more Zachs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Questions of President LaRiviere?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome. You commented that, I made a note here, that every Oregon student that qualified was accepted.
Right.
Kudos for that. That's exciting. I like that piece. So I guess I would ask what percentage, and I briefly looked through here, maybe I missed it because I really wanted to listen to you more than I wanted to look through this. What percentage of your students are Oregon students right now?
62% of our students, Representative Springer, are from the state of Oregon.
Okay. Follow up, please. Has that been a pretty consistent trend, or does that go up and down? How does that fluctuate, and what would cause that to fluctuate?
I don't know over the long term. I know that since I've been here, that number is within 1% or 2% has been pretty steady. The reason that this is of some considerable concern to us is that out-of-state students pay about 2.5 times the cost of their education,
yeah,
and in-state students pay about 50%. And so we are able to subsidize, through a transfer of those funds, the in-state students.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, anybody that wants to take note of that question before they present, I'll be asking that consistently.
No, it is an important question, I think. And actually, I'll just follow up that question with, another growing trend, I would assume, is that more of your upper division students are transferring in from community colleges. And I wonder if you could speak to that.
Yes, we had a record number of transfer students last year. And as you know, Mr. Chairman, it's always difficult to know precisely why any given student comes to any particular institution, but it's our sense that, particularly in this economic downturn, that many more students are availing themselves of community colleges for the first 2 years for financial expediency.
So would it be fair to say that, you know, if you look at the students who are freshmen and sophomores, there's a higher number of out-of-state students,
right,
and then as those community college students come in as juniors and seniors, then that gets you to that two-thirds point.
Yes, that's exactly right. Our freshman class last year was 49% out-of-state, but it had only a marginal effect on the overall balance precisely because of the transfer issue.
Right. Great. Rep. Lindsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Part of this committee is to hold people accountable. I'm wondering if you could explain why the Ducks lost to that Southeast team. You don't need to answer that.
Had to do with refereeing.
Actually, two questions, Mr. Chair, if that's all right. Actually, you qualified your statement by saying every qualified student. I'm wondering if you could explain that a little bit further. And when you do so, if you explain how many students are competing for each seat at the University of Oregon? That's the first question. And then the second question is, I dare say that your graduation rate and retention rate is higher, or competing for one of the highest that I've seen. I'm wondering if you have any insight or specific things that you've done to keep that up.
Yes, sir. With regard to the competition per seats, I think we had something like 22 or 23,000 applications for 4,000 seats last year. And we are moving to a new admissions regime next year that will no longer have a specific grade point average as the guaranteed admission, but rather a threshold of the possibility of success. And that is a dramatic shift away from focusing on three numbers for admission: grade point average, test score, and class rank. because we want to make sure that we are giving an adequate set of opportunities to those kids who come from particularly high schools that may not offer 2 years of language to them, or that haven't had an adequate number of AP opportunities, et cetera, so that we give those kids the same level of scrutiny that we do to anyone else, and don't penalize anyone for not having an adequate grade point or SAT score. With regard to our retention, you're right, our retention numbers are the best in the state, but they're not good enough in my view. Our retention, freshman retention rate of 88% is a dramatic improvement over the previous couple of years, but I have told the admissions and advising people that I want a minimum of 90% retention for freshmen. And our six-year graduation rate of 67-68% is again the best in the state, but it is not good enough in my view. 75% should be our minimum there in my view, and I would really, really like to see that four-year graduation rate ratcheted up dramatically, because the fifth year is so crushingly expensive for students. They think about only the money they're spending for their education, but they haven't calculated their foregone income at their first job as well. And I want to get that number up.
Thank you. Rick Johnson, you had maybe our last question before we move on. Did you have a question?
There's that last question remaining. May I help you, sir?
Yes. Okay, he is yielding his time to you, Rick Parker.
Thank you, both co-chairs. Thanks, Mr. President, for being here. You, along with the other presidents, bring tremendous dedication and inspiration to us here, and
I thank you
all for that, and you in particular, sir, since you're at the seat right now. I would also like to direct a couple of comments to you, Zach, and about you, about people like you, because when we think about the economic impact of the institution, it is much bigger than we sometimes think, and I think that you could be perhaps an example of how it gets even larger. There's a ripple effect of people coming out without debt who are free to pursue some dreams. I have a business of 28 employees that I was able to start because I did not have crushing debt when I came out of my PhD program, because I was supported by an NSF stipend, all right, National Science Foundation. If we can support some of these folks who are on a pretty high trajectory and get them out in a situation where they're free to pursue creative solutions to problems we're facing, we're going to benefit in numerous ways. So thanks. Go, man, go.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd call up President Ed Ray from Oregon State.
Well, thank
you. Yeah. I'm trying.
Once in a while, get it right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I apologize for the sore throat. I think it started last Saturday when our women were down 20 points at halftime and ended up winning. After that, I kind of took a slide in terms of my ability to speak.
Excuse me, Mr. President.
I'm Ed Ray, president of Oregon State University. Very pleased to be with you here today. I brought two documents with me. One is a statement to the Portland City Club in January, when Chancellor Pernsteiner and I both talked to the City Club about the change in governance proposals. And I know that Senate Bill 242 is the current document that's in play. And I also brought more detailed comments about the institution that are here for you as well, so I stay well within my 10 minutes, hopefully. First, let me say that I really strongly endorse Senate Bill 242. As I said in my City Club comments, it is about governance, but it's about much more. It's about efficient management of the institutions, and it's about accountability to the people of Oregon. Somebody asked me in the Q&A there, what do the people of Oregon get out of a change in the governance structure? And what I said to them, and I'll repeat to you, is I guarantee you that at any level of funding, we will graduate more students as a system than we're able to do as an agency because of the uncertainty and cost increasing elements associated with the ambiguities of being treated as a state agency. We talked a little bit in, you talked a little bit in the Q&A in the last discussion about first-year retention, six-year graduation rates. Our first-year retention rate's a little over 85%, six-year graduation rate about 65%. It's not good enough. And so I'm really interested in seeing us move to a state system as opposed to a state agency because I think it's important that we do a lot better than we are, and that change will help us in that regard. I want to talk about three topics, and we'll see how much I get through. I want to talk about access and affordability, about the role of the institution in economic development, and then tell you a little bit about what we're doing to be more efficient in our operations at the university to deal with the demands for our services and the realities of the resources that we're working with. Our enrollment is now, counting the Cascades campus, at a record 25,000. We have the highest number of Oregonians in the history of the university at over 17,000 Oregonians. Our resident undergraduate enrollment has grown since I came here in 2003 from about 13,600 to about 15,200. So we've continued to try to maintain that. And Representative Spranger, you asked about the percentage of Oregonians in our student population. For us, it's about 75%. Our commitment to Oregon underrepresented populations is also reflected in progress we've made with enrollment. We have over 4,000 students from historically underrepresented groups, so they now represent about 18% of our total enrollment. We have, we call it eCampus, our online program for students that now provides courses for about 4,200 students, and that compares with about 1,800 only 6 years ago. So we've been growing that program very rapidly. We also have a program called the Degree Partnership Program. This is a program that allows students to simultaneously enroll in a community college and the university. We have a degree partnership program agreement with each of the 17 community colleges in the state. We started this program in 1998 with Lynn Benton Community College, and since then we've had more than 12,000 students enter OSU through that degree partnership program. We're very proud of it. In terms of affordability, one aspect of our current campaign for OSU, this is our university-wide fundraising campaign, which now is about $670 million on our way to a goal of $850 million by 2013. One aspect of that is we've raised about $111 million in scholarship funds. As a result of that, and as a result of using Pell Grant eligibility and remissions, we've created a program we call Bridge to Success. And it's a program for Oregon undergraduate students that permits them to go to Oregon State University without paying any tuition and fees at all. Each of the last 3 years that that program has been in place, we have about 3,000 students who pay no tuition and fees. Oregon undergraduate students who are able to go to the university. We have many projects. You can see the information in the handout I left behind on facilities and construction and activity that we're undertaking to try to meet the demands of the students we have. I mentioned the 25,000 students. Excuse me, it's worth pointing out that our enrollment has grown about 8% in each of the last 2 years. The Cascades campus is now celebrating its 10th anniversary. Okay. Enrollment at the Cascades campus has actually grown 20% last year and 11% this year. And they're adding new programs that meet regional demands, such as the hospitality management program and an energy engineering program. So we feel very good about the efforts that are going on at our Cascades campus. I know that Dean Hal Salwasser had a chance to meet with the committee and talk about the statewide public services, the incredible work they do across the state, the challenges they face given the budget proposal. I could spend more than 10 minutes just talking about that, but I'll presume that my colleague gave you the information that you need. Let me talk a little bit about the contribution of the university to economic development and progress in the state. Last year, our faculty brought in $275 million in research grants and contracts last year, and that represents a doubling of our research portfolio in the last 10 years. Just recently, last week, you may have read that we're part of a $20 million U.S. Department of Agricultural consortium to look at what can be done to preserve wheat production in the Northwest and what other changes in agriculture may have to occur because of climate change. That's an example of many of the things that we undertake. In terms of connecting to industry and businesses and jobs, in the last 4 years, we've had 89 U.S. and foreign patents. We've issued 156 licenses, and some of those are really quite profound. For example, we're working with Hewlett-Packard on transparent electronics, transistors, and integrated circuits, and many believe that that will actually lead to whole new industries as a result of those technology breakthroughs. We've had 10 startups in the last few years. They've brought in addition to launching, they've brought in $140 million in additional investment in their activities, and they've created almost 200 jobs in just the last few years. So let me turn to operating efficiency. What are we doing to manage our affairs better? We updated our university strategic plan and identified three signature areas we want to focus on for excellence in the future. Our aspiration is to be one of the top 10 land-grant universities in America. The areas that we're focusing on are sustainable earth ecosystems, improving human health and wellness, and economic development, and then the arts and sciences are the underpinning for all of that. Well, we've taken that concept, and we've actually clustered our 11 colleges into four divisions under those headings, and we're working within those divisions to create new programs, new majors, minors, and to consolidate our operating costs by moving business activities like personnel and fiscal into what we call campus business centers. So instead of having personnel and finance in every department, in every college, and in the college, we have 7 business centers. And as a result of that, we've been able to reduce the staffing for that part of the business activity from about 200 to about 165. We've realized performance improvements, accuracy, efficiency in the work that people are able to do. We're also realigning on the academic side. We ask people to look at low enrollment classes and see to what extent majors, minors, low enrollment courses could be eliminated so we could better move the resources where the demand pressures are. As a result, we're able to eliminate about 15 to 20% of our low enrollment class offerings and to move those resources elsewhere. In a total sense, we're in the process, and obviously the Faculty Senate and the university processes have to work their magic, but we're going from 63 academic units of all kinds to 36, which is pretty extraordinary. And just to give you an idea of one of the proposals that's out there, our College of Liberal Arts has proposed reducing its operations from 13 departments and 2 programs to 6 schools and 1 program. And that's got to be one of the, if I think it is, the hardest area in the university to create change and have people embrace it. And I think people are pretty excited about the possibilities that's creating. Let me end with an observation that the Legislative Fiscal Office and the Department of Administrative Services made in a memorandum to the E-Board just June 10th. Of this past year, 2010. And basically, they applauded OSU for, and I quote, being diligent in containing costs and continuing efforts to find efficiencies. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. President. Questions of President Ray?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming up today and certainly for your presentation and catching my question. I appreciate that.
Good question.
But forgive me, you missed just a little piece of it, which is what has been your trend over the last few years? Has that gone up and down a lot?
It's
75%, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's actually lower than it's been historically. I think we've had a real surge for reasons that are not, you know, partly we've tried to be prudent about in-state, out-of-state, because we are the state land-grant university. But at the same time, there are tremendous pressures because of events in California, Washington, elsewhere in the country, and also internationally, more and more students wanting to come to the United States and study. On the international front, we're actually working very hard to double our international enrollment. And that's part of the idea of creating a diverse community within which all of our students can learn, because they're going to be competing and working in a globally connected, globally competitive environment, and they need to be able to work with everybody. So the international growth that we've had has been intentional, but I don't know if I said it. When I came in 2003, we were at about 13,600 in-state students. Now it's about 15 undergraduate residents. Now it's about 15,200.
Thank you.
So. Other questions? Rep. Johnson.
I was yielding to Rep. Parker.
Rep. Parker.
Again, you yield.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot to be said. Thank you for being here, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And for all you do. There's a lot to be said for efficiency. I imagine that your Faculty Senate is bristling at the need to eliminate some of those low enrollment classes. Spoken as a person who took a good number of those low enrollment classes, and I wish we could support you to the level where you didn't need to do quite as much as you are. I have a question, though. That's just a comment. I have a question, if I may, about the something you noted about the Cascades campus. Notes I made were that they have programs available to fill local demand, reasonably accurate.
Creating new majors. Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. What's the means of input for making those decisions, means of input from the local community? Is there an institutional or a local board? If not, how would that play into this?
Yeah, they actually had a community group that included representatives from the Cascades campus, Central Oregon Community College, from city council, business leaders in the community. They came together, and I'm forgetting what the acronym stands for, but they created an organization called HEAT, and it's the Higher Education Advancement something or other. But they put out a white paper about what they believe the needs of Central Oregon are going forward, and they were very instrumental in helping us understand what Cascades needs to be doing to be most responsive to their needs. The idea of having, for example, energy engineering management major came out of those discussions.
Great. Thank you.
Absolutely. And our faculty, I would agree with you, it's not just a matter of reducing low enrollment courses for the sake of doing it. I've been telling my colleagues for years, we're a community of overachievers. We're trying to still do everything, and we really have to decide what's mission critical and what are the things we really can sustain. And that's why we went to the three signature areas in the strategic plan. And it doesn't sit up on a shelf. We actually have conversations where we say, you know, maybe we should have a major and this or that. And someone will ask, well, what's that got to do with the strategic plan? How does that align with what we said as an institution we want to accomplish? So I don't think people feel so much that they're having things taken away from them. I've been very pleased to see people very excited about what's being created. One of those CLA schools is a school of public policy, and they're trying to come up with an interdisciplinary PhD program, and they are really excited about it. So it's an opportunity as well.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just have one quick question following up on that. I know that to create a new program, you have to go through a process that includes the State Board of Higher Education.
Right.
Is there a parallel process when you want to discontinue a program? That is there a system-wide look at that to see, is this program being offered elsewhere? Do students in the state have options?
Yeah, and I'm actually recalling this from past many, many board meetings. But when we are discontinuing a program, that comes before the OUS board. They know that we've made that proposal. And they do worry about, you know, does that create an unmet need in the state, or is it something that can, in fact, be managed?
Great.
So it is orchestrated on the system-wide level.
Good. I think that's very important. Okay, thank you very much, Mr.
I'm
President.
Sorry subjecting you to this.
No, you've kept an appropriate distance from us.
One quick question before you get away, and I'm sorry to tax your vocal cords even further, but in your talking about in-state students, the number of high school students that are going directly from high schools into OSU, and I'm wondering what your sense is for their ability to perform right out of high school. And I ask that along with the concept of, you know, we've got some new diploma requirements for our K-12 students that I think the class of, 14, I think, will be the first students that will fully be graduating with that new matrix. But I'm just wondering how well it plays into your course design and so forth. If you guys are anticipating perhaps you're going to get students from the state that are going to be more equipped to really take off and go, require less remedial, you know, education and that kind of stuff. But could you just kind of generally talk about how you view how our K-12 system right now is preparing students for the university systems?
Well, we actually feel that most of the students who come to us, you know, we accept them with the expectation that if they apply themselves, they have the capability to be successful. We have a program we use, as Richard said, we don't just use grades and class rank and SATs. We created something called the Insight Resume about 5 years ago that many universities across the country are copying, where we ask students about, you know, what's their motivation been, what clubs have they belonged to, what leadership roles have they taken, and our people are able to see among those who, you know, in terms of the hitting the right points, may not look as strong, but they can tell who, you know, who the Zach Taylors are if they're not as good. I'm sure Zach was wonderful as a high school student too, but they can see students who have that drive and potential even if it doesn't show up in their academic performance. We also have just started a program, a kind of bridge program, for every student we think is at risk coming in. We have a special program for them where they have mentors and peers to work with, so that we do everything we can to help them be successful. You know, I hope these standards help make the transition even more effective going forward, but we're not assuming that. And we also understand that the entering classes that we're seeing will become more and more diverse over time and come often from poorer and poorer economic circumstances and simply need help. So we're gearing up to do more. You know, a little bit of help from K-12 would be great.
Thank you very much, President Ray. Okay, I'd call up President Bivel from that university up in Portland.
Well, you're probably not altogether sorry that two of my colleagues got stuck on the other side of the show. I can't imagine what it is like to get five of us in a row. But thank you very much.
You're an articulate group.
Sure, that's why you were very wise to give us just 10 minutes. We used the 50-minute increments. Let me just give you a few numbers to start. 29,818. We couldn't quite get it to 30,000. We'll be there next year for sure. 80% of whom are Oregon residents. That's 18,360. And that's been pretty stable the last few years, although we would like to increase that sum for all the obvious reasons, both diversity, that's really a big reason, as well as the financial side. $58 million in research funding, most of that federal money, so that's new money, new jobs, etc., for Oregon. And we provide jobs for about 4,000 employees. We are one of the larger employers in the Portland metropolitan area, and our total economic impact is about $1.4 billion a year, so very significant. The numbers matter. We, obviously the largest university in the state in terms of numbers. Also, the largest number of degrees. You know, it ultimately matters that they also get out with a degree. So we awarded the largest number of degrees last year that any Oregon university had ever awarded. Also, a place of opportunity. 45% of our first-time freshmen were the first in their family to go to college. That's 500 kids who came to PSU who were the first ones in their family. We're very proud of that. And we are the educational destination for an increasing number of the state's growing Latino population. We have the largest number of Latino students of any of the institutions. It's now 6% of our student body. And however, because of the size of that population in the K-12 system, we have recently launched an effort called Exito to double the number of Latino students, and we have a whole bunch of specifics that I can elaborate on if you want to try to achieve this. And all of this is intended to really help achieve the 40-40-20 goal. But while being a place of opportunity, we also want to be a place of choice. And I'm very proud that last year, more of Multnomah County's valedictorians chose PSU than any other institution. We had 20 valedictorians from Portland Metropolitan Schools, high schools coming to PSU. These are all good things. We have much work to do on the retention side. This has been something that I think the institution did not pay enough attention to. As it grew by about 50% over the decade before I came, did not invest in the staff that is needed. We invested this past year $1 million in hiring 40 new advisors. We instituted mandatory orientation and advising for all students. We now require all students to declare a major earlier. We would often have students not declaring a major till sort of the day before they graduated, which meant that they weren't closely connected to any department. And we greatly reduced the number of special admits to a cohort of students that we felt we could adequately serve. Special admits are those students who don't meet our admission standards, but basically they could write a letter pleading their case. Our admission staff, being good, bleeding-heart liberals, basically let them all in. And then we found that many of them flunked out very quickly. So we said we can only handle so many of these. That's how many staff we have, and that's how many we now admit. So I expect our freshman to sophomore retention rate was 73.5%. I think it will go up by 2 or 3 points, I hope, this year. And I would like it to get in that 75 to 80% range. One way also to make sure that happens is to make sure the K-12 system does its role very well. We have played a lead role in convening something called the Cradle to Career Initiative, which brings together all of the school systems in Multnomah County, the Leaders Roundtable, the Portland Schools Foundation, the mayor, the county chair, to really streamline that pipeline process. And again, I can talk at great length about that, but I'm very proud of our role in that, and it's critical for so many universities in the state, because students from Portland, of course, go to universities throughout the state. On the question of affordability, you know, as you know, that after adjusting for inflation, the cost of education, that is the amount of money we spend per student, has actually stayed quite stable over the past 20 years. But the price has doubled because the amount of money that the student pays it now is two-thirds of the cost, whereas the state pays one-third, whereas 20 years ago it was pretty much the opposite. To help with this, we helped backfill, as our colleagues did, $2.2 million over the last 2 years of money that had been guaranteed by the Oregon Opportunity Grant, but that then was not available. Additional funding for that program, as well as what happens to the federal Pell Grant program, is absolutely critical to maintain affordability. While we have some private scholarships, and we will look to increase that further, one big difference between PSU and OSU, and you have already heard from it, our foundation is vastly smaller. It's only about $30, $34 million in endowment, whereas the other two have endowments of around the $400, $500 million range. So vast difference in what we have available. And the as long as the state contribution stays as low as it is or goes down, unless you really sacrifice quality, affordability is going to get hit. He asked us to talk about partnerships with colleges and universities. You are familiar, of course, with the signature research centers that we have with the other institutions. We have the Oregon Executive MBA with the other institutions, the Public Health Master's degree with OHSU. Even at least as important, certainly very important from the accessibility side, are our articulation and co-admission processes, which we have in place with every community college in the state. But we offer on-site advising at three locations, Chemeketa, Mount Hood, and PCC Rock Creek, because that's where the vast bulk of our transfer students come from. We also partner with Blue Mountain Community College on several online courses, and we have several other specialized programs. The community college students who come in with an associate degree do very well. Their retention and graduation rate is about 80%, which is, of course, very good. One important thing, by the way, the federal retention and graduation rate, which is calculated after 6 years for first-time full-time freshmen, for PSU, if you draw it out to 10 years, we actually increase our retention rate by quite a lot. It adds another 8 percentage points. So PSU students, partly because they can, because they're people who live there in town, do sometimes take that very long time to graduate while they're working. In terms of partnerships, the other very important one for us is our strategic alliance that we announced last fall with OHSU. And we're looking to expand and really build on the many things we already do together. Dual enrollment courses, make the process for joint faculty appointments even easier, identify more opportunities for collaborative research, combine administrative functions, and so on. And we will be talking shortly about the School of Public Health that OHSU will take the lead on, but we will be a collaborating partner on. And of course, we're working with them on the Life Sciences Building on the South Waterfront. At the level of connections with the community, we have about 1,000 active partnerships with businesses, government, community organizations. Programs such as the Business Outreach Program, which provides consultation services, major collaborative arrangement with Portland General Electric, where we are actually guided by memorandum of agreement that we have with them, which lays out it will be working on green building issues and on electrical vehicle issues. So that's how we focus it, and they have provided significant support. And much smaller but very attractive ones, we're opening a Ben & Jerry scoop shop on our urban plaza that will be run by at-risk youth through the New Avenues for Youth program, and our social work students will be working with these students. Just a wonderful partnership program. We also have our own business accelerator, which focuses on helping startup companies, particularly those involved in high tech, biotech, and green tech. They generated $6 million last year in grant money, $5 million in sales, and $68 million in private venture investments. A very promising development. And the Portland Development Commission just helped us build additional wet lab space, which will make the space even more attractive. President Obama, when he was visiting Intel last week, singled out one of our graduates. He did an undergraduate at the University of Oregon and did his PhD in chemistry at PSU, Nabil Miskawi, while he was working at PSU. And he developed 9 patents while he was still a student, which is saving Intel millions and millions of dollars a year in a new process of chip manufacturing. And we were very glad to be featured by the president. Overall, our students provide more than 1.5 million hours of volunteer service to about 600 organizations. I mentioned earlier our research at $58 million. That's up by more than 50% since just 2 years ago. So huge growth, and we expect that growth to continue. We have a goal of doubling this. We focus on 3 key areas: sustainability, K-20 education, and health and life sciences. In the latter area, health and life sciences, it focuses, of course, on our work with OHSU. In the K-12 area, it focuses on this cradle-to-career initiative in Multnomah County, as well as on the area of STEM and training teachers to be more effective. We have a $7 million National Science Foundation grant to work with teachers in Washington County primarily to increase their capacity to teach in the STEM areas. In the sustainability, and by the way, on the cradle to career, I want to thank Representative Johnson. I think you sent to all your colleagues the column by Anna Griffin about the cradle to career initiative.
Mr. President, we'll need you to wrap up.
I'm almost done.
Thank you.
Our the sustainability research, of course, is anchored by the $25 million gift from the Miller Foundation, and it's headed by the Institute for Sustainable Solutions. I just want to end by very briefly expressing my support for the restructuring discussion that the legislature is considering. Having the level of regulation we have combined with the low level of funding we have is not a good situation. I know many of you are looking at this, and we think while it certainly does not begin to solve the funding issues, and I don't want anybody to think that, it is an important step forward to giving us the freedom, a little bit more freedom that is, a little more speed, and it will save us some money. People who now spend their time getting the 6th signature or the 8th approval for something will be able to do things that are more productive than that. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. President. Questions?
Thank you for answering my question right off the bat. Appreciate that.
Any other questions for President Bubel? President Bell, I should say that we're going to be inviting you back at some point in the future to talk more about the partnership with OHSU and what initiatives are already underway and what you're considering in the future.
We're very much looking forward to that.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment.
Yes.
I just wanted to reiterate the comment you made in my office a couple weeks ago about what you folks all did to increase your retention, you know, taking those initiatives to add on the additional counselors or facilitators that are needed, and then also refining somewhat your process for, you know, admittance and so forth. But I just want to applaud you guys for that action, because, you know, sometimes there's common sense things we need to do, but obviously, you know, kids need help, they need guidance and so forth to make sure that they're navigating that system efficiently, because every kid that gets into the system has some resources invested in them, and we want to make sure that they're up to the task, but also that they're getting the guidance they need so that they can navigate that system efficiently and get out to be successfully employed and be contributing back to the state and so forth. So I just wanted to congratulate you guys for the action you took there.
Great. Thank you very much. And, of course, this is the other side of efficiency, that for most administrative functions, our expenditures are somewhere between 50 and 60% of our peers. Guess what? That means that we have fewer people doing things that, in some cases, we really, really need. It. You can only drive efficiency so far, and until you really begin to notice it on the effectiveness side.
Great. And I would just remind the committee that the students at Portland State are, most of them are not kids, actually.
Right.
They, many of them are really older, and they're on lifelong career paths, and Portland State does a great job of educating them.
Thank you. Rep. Parker had a comment.
Sorry, Rep. Parker.
You can leave me out if we need to move on. I can have the conversation offline.
I yield to the representative.
You're doing a lot of yielding.
Quickly. Here I go then. Okay. Thanks for being here. Welcome. We heard from the dean of the OHSU Med School recently, and one of the comments that he made was, according to my notes here, not to put words in his mouth, but they can't get enough high-quality applicants from Oregon high schools and universities to fill some of their slots. The number of applicants from the universities in Oregon has remained very constant over time. Wondering if you have any comments in the very brief amount of time that we have about the changes that might come about as in that regard as a result of the collaboration that you are now undertaking with some of the other campuses and OHSU.
But we are the biggest feeder of the OHSU Medical School, and every fall there is not a single seat left in introductory chemistry at anywhere in the Portland metropolitan area, in fact, because we go to our sister institutions, to the community college, to borrow seats in chemistry classes because there's such a demand for those. Many of those are the pre-med people, of course, who wind up there. That's why we need that space that we're now building in the life sciences building on the waterfront. That's just one example of addressing that need. Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. President. And I'd like to thank all three presidents for braving the dry roads.
Blizzard.
I'm sorry.
It's a blizzard.
Yeah.
Sorry. Speaking as a former New Englander, I found it very easy to get to work today. So anyway. So with that, I'm going to close this informational hearing on Oregon universities. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2866. And House Bill 2866 is a measure that's related to a lot of what we've been talking about today, that is student access, student success, in this case having to do with transfer. And it's a bill that was sponsored by Representative Wisnant, and I would invite him up to introduce the people who are going to talk to us. I will also say, colleagues, that the representative and I are working together with the Oregon Community College Association on another bill, a related bill, that would create a transfer student bill of rights for the state, and you'll be hearing more about that. Representative Wisdom, welcome.
Good afternoon, and I am glad everyone got here, co-chairs. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnant, State Representative, House District 53. And my driveway was cleared this week of 2 feet of snow, so I'm in Sun River. Thank the Chair Devlin for that comments and look forward to working with him. Today, honorable colleagues, I bring you a bill, House Bill 2866, that's very important to me. This bill requires the Joint Board of Education to adopt a comprehensive transfer system for students of community colleges and state institutions of higher education. An improved higher education credit transfer policy will reduce the cost of a degree and expedite the time to earn a degree. Oregon's made some great positive steps towards improving transferability of credits. But this bill requires the effort to move forward at a greater pace and implement it before 2012-2013 school years. Chief of Staff Bridget Burns from the OUS has talked to me about extending that deadline, and I'm open to do that. I don't want to extend it too far, but I'm willing to work with her. And you're also going to hear from Dr. Green, the Vice President of Tillamook Bay Community College today, and she has some amendments that I'll be glad to work with them to incorporate those amendments. But my objective with this bill is to keep the attention on this issue, because it deserves so much attention. And it will produce the graduates for Oregon to compete successfully in the 21st century economy. I've had the pleasure and the honor of attending several higher education conferences that talked about reform. And always, transfer of credit programs is always one of the most important ways to increase the number of graduates and expedite the time to earn a degree. I first entered this body in 2003. Mrs. Burns provided me a little fact sheet from Oregon University System. I don't know if you have. But again, they talk about, it talks about, when I, and that's when I entered the building, 2003, and they talk about six-year graduation rates. My family, just we just could afford the 4 years. 6 years is really difficult. I'm going to quote and give you some facts from the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy, a research from a May 2010 article. Over half of today's college graduates transfer from another school at least once during their academic career. With each transfer, the student is actually paying a transfer tax, losing some of the academic credits they have earned due to school policies that make it difficult for students to transfer credits from one institution to another. The drain on the economy and lost time and money reaches into the billions of dollars. I saw one report, $30 billion. And I'm not sure that they didn't. I didn't put that in my letter to you, which you have a copy of, because it didn't say for a year or for total or whatever. But this is the reason that more than 40 million American adults currently have some college credits, but no certificate or degree. A Gates Foundation study found that more than 50% of all higher education spending in the United States, including financial aid, funds services for people who never receive a degree or a certificate. And the transfer barriers are disproportionately large for students from lower socioeconomic backgrounds and for minority students. Honorable colleagues, the European Union, universities throughout Europe have begun a project called the Bologna Process, whereby the EU participating nations accept credits from each other. Let's catch up to them. I'll be glad to work with the community colleges and the Oregon University system to make this bill better, but please, I urge you to keep this bill. Let's help our students get their degrees cheaper and quicker, and I would ask you to pass this bill. Thank you very much, and I'll be available for questions.
Thank you, Representative. Colleagues, any questions for the representative? Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have direct experience with this. I went to community college and then transferred. And when I transferred, I visited with that the receiving school, saying that you'll accept all my credits, right? Right. And I got it in writing. And then when I went to graduate, they said, we're not going to accept that. And thankfully, I had my piece of paper. I said, yes, you will accept it. My question.
This was before you received your law degree.
That's right. That's
right.
You can see my character a little bit. So I saw that, and I see it as something. I do wonder, and I'm sure this will probably come out in hearings, but I just wonder what other schools are saying about this, what counterarguments are there, because I can see in my mind some institutions that will not want to accept a class from such and such because it just wasn't up to par. And I understand that the big picture is to set up some system in place that it's uniform, but I'm wondering if you have any inkling, yeah, off the top of your head on what other schools might, what concerns are already out there.
Yeah, co-chairs and Representative Lindsay, you'll get some testimony, I think, later from the universities and the community college about the difficulty of doing this. But my message to today, this has got to be corrected. It's got to be corrected. And we can do it, but it's got to be, and that's why I'm willing to change the date. But let's, and again, you're going to hear about, we've done some good things in the packages of transferability credits, and you'll hear about that from the people that will testify later about how you can go to community college and take a package and go from community college to, we need to do more of that. I just think, and I know from experience, my military background, I've seen it from young troops that, you know, move here and there, and we're a mobile society now. It's not where you go to one school, and we also have more people working. So this is a states are doing it. To Representative Lindsay's question, they are doing it. States realize one of the conferences I went to talked about Oregon needing 64,000 more graduates with a certificate or degree a year to compete, and we're not. So we need to find ways to do this. I've been briefed, and I'm optimistic about the OUS change in policy and operation, where we're doing based upon graduation rates and not admissions. I think that's a key thing to make this system work, and I think that hopefully the university presidents and the chancellor will make this happen. I think it can happen. We can come up with standard courses. The article I read had some different computer programs where you get everyone to agree on the courses. But we've got to keep up. Other countries are doing it, and we need to find ways to make this happen. And I think that we have the leadership in Oregon, and it starts right here with you to pass this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Representative, for bringing this bill forward and for kicking this off.
Thank you.
So now let's call up. We have a panel that is bi-sector or multi-sector. We have Karen Sprague from University of Oregon. Karen, are you from University of Oregon or U.S.? I never. Yeah, great. Joe Holliday from OUS. And Krissa Caldwell, come back, from the CCWD. So let's, you decide who goes first, if you'd introduce yourself, and colleagues, if you have specific questions of information, go ahead and ask them, and otherwise let's hear them all and hold substantive questions.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. For the record, my name is Joe Holliday. I serve the Oregon University System as Assistant Vice Chancellor for Student Success Initiatives. And we are here today to give you a little bit of past, present, and future on this. My colleague Karen Sprague, who is a Vice Provost indeed at the University of Oregon, is here representing OUS today, and my colleague Krissa Caldwell from the community colleges as well. In terms of just review of the past, and we know time is short, so we'll be brief. Karen was a key OUS participant in the work of implementing Senate Bill 342 from the 2005 session, which shares language with this bill, and we believe is very relevant. We don't want to assume that everything is known about what has been done. So Karen's going to briefly take you through what was done. It's a remarkable story, really. I'll talk about what we are doing currently in those areas, and I believe Krissa will do a little bit of that as well and talk about it from a community college perspective. And I don't want to speak for Krissa or the community colleges, but I believe we're all interested in moving forward, doing better with transfer and articulation, but wanting to know more about what this bill requires beyond what we're already doing. That way we can come up with a better fiscal analysis and maybe talk more about the timeline for implementation and do a better job of serving Oregon this way. So with that, I'll hand it over to Karen.
Thank you very much, Chair Denbrough and members of the committee. I appreciate the time that you're giving us today. And for the record, my name is Karen Sprague. I'm here today as a member of the Joint Board's Articulation Commission and also an assistant to the Chancellor in responding to Senate Bill 342. So that was a bill that asked us to do a better job with articulation and transfer in Oregon. And we took that opportunity to not only respond to the specific provisions of the bill, but to try to set up a system that would be robust enough, a sort of a framework, really, that would be robust enough to guide articulation and transfer over time and to be able to respond to additional problems or needs that might arise. So by we, I mean that this was a very close collaboration between the Oregon University System and the community colleges and also the private universities in the state that engage in significant transfer. And what we realized is that we needed two fundamental elements in the system as a whole, one conceptual and one technical. The conceptual one was agreement on the principles that ought to guide the selection of courses that would be widely transferable. And to achieve that, we needed to get agreement of faculty in all the different kinds of institutions in particular disciplines on what constituted good courses in those disciplines. Now, here I'm not really talking about majors. I'm talking about general education, because what we recognize is that the outcomes of general education are broad. That is, we ask students to take courses in the social sciences, for example. It's not critical that they all take, in fact, it's probably not even desirable, that they take the same courses. But we want them to get a sense of what the social sciences are. Likewise, we want them to get a sense of what natural science is. And we hope that we could come up with a set of criteria in those broad areas that would, if courses met those criteria, then we would all agree that they would be universally transferable everywhere in Oregon. And we did that. So something like 140 some odd faculty in the various disciplines participated, as I say, from all kinds of institutions. And all I can say is that it was much easier to do this than any of us thought it was going to be at the outset. We got the faculty together. There really wasn't disagreement about what constitutes a good science course, and we came up with criteria for such courses. So now, general education courses on their own, not when they're part of a package, but just even on their own, can transfer everywhere, and we all agree to count them. The technical element we needed for a good system was something, a computer system, to keep track of all of the course equivalencies. This we needed more for majors rather than general education, because we've all agreed general education courses can transfer everywhere. But majors are trickier because there are very specific relationships among particular courses. I mean, we just heard about the need for general chemistry, for example, for students who are intending to go to medical school. So what we needed was something to keep track of those course equivalencies for majors once they've been established. They have been established on campuses, and through articulation agreements, they're often shared among campuses, but they're not easily accessible to students and advisors. So it's very hard if you're a student planning to major in something, but also thinking about changing institutions, to think about how to plan your courses at your home institution or at the institution where you presently are that will fit with a program somewhere else. But we set up a computer system. There are now wonderful web-based systems that allow you to do this so that you, as a student, you can compare the coursework you've already completed or the coursework you're thinking about taking with any degree program in the state and see how it will match up. Make sure that you're making the right choices. That system is in place for OUS schools. It's not, as I think Joe will indicate, it's not completely finished. But all seven OUS campuses are plugged into it. Unfortunately, it's only partially established for the community colleges, and you'll hear more about that. So we established that basic framework, and I think that is the kind of thing that can keep us going in the future. We also then solved some specific problems that had plagued people. One was that the Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer degree, so that's a transferable two-year degree, all the coursework is transferable. That was intended to be a single kind of degree, but it had diverged over time and had become different on different campuses, and that limited some of the horizontal transfer of students from community college to community college. And with a lot of leadership from people like Connie Green and Carol Schaffsma, and really all of the leaders on the individual community college campuses, amazingly, 17 community colleges came together, and there's now a uniform AAOT degree. We established the Oregon Transfer Module, which is sort of like half of an AAOT degree. That it's an organization of general education coursework for a single year rather than 2 years, again, to help students plan and transfer. We standardized credit for advanced placement and for international baccalaureate test scores. Again, those had differed on different campuses, making it confusing for students. And there, really, it was Connie Green and Robert Mercer at PSU who led the work. And then we also made a study of the dual credit opportunities in the state. This is credit that's college credit that students earn while they're still in high school. We wanted to see geographically where those opportunities were available, and we also wanted to see if the programs were following sort of standard approaches and methods And we also did a study to see how successful the students emerging from those programs were when they later went on with coursework based on what they'd taken as dual credit. The story that emerged was very encouraging. I think our programs are good. They are spread around the state. We could use some more of them in certain areas, but they're more widely distributed than I think we imagined to set out to begin with. And I think the really exciting thing is that the group decided on their own, that is the schools that offer dual credit programs decided on their own to adopt the excellent national standards for these programs. And so we're now part, we use those standards and they're very high and they're very well respected. So we set up this great system. Is it doing anything? It's too soon, unfortunately, to have actual data, because the whole thing really just went into effect a year ago. So we don't have numbers of transfer students and the number of credits that they've taken to see if this is increasing efficiency. We do know, however, that all of the community colleges are revising their general education curricula based on the new criteria that have been created. And that's a very that's a fine thing. It's a remarkable undertaking. And we also know that our system has been held up as a model for other states, so that at least we know that other people think it looks good. And we are still waiting to get some actual data to see that it's working.
Thank you, Karen. Krista, did you?
Chair Debra, members of the committee. I guess I should be
I know my voice isn't very loud, so I'll need this. My name is Krista Caldwell. I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and I'm here today representing Commissioner Camp Royce. All of the, I'm going to speak to the web-based self-advising tool. All 17 community colleges are connected and have access and capability to annually upload a file of current courses to the system. This allows a student to evaluate courses they have completed when compared to courses and programs at one of Oregon University institutions or any college currently in the national system. The tool essentially validates that the course a student enters as having completed is indeed offered by one of the 17 community colleges. Now that the AA, the Associate of Arts Transfer, Oregon Transfer degree is uniform, the agency is working with Lynn Benton Community College and Chemeketa Community College to add it to the web-based system. This work will be completed this spring in preparation for the next school year. The Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer degree is an approved statewide degree common to all community colleges and transferable to all OUS institutions. Adding it to the system enhances self-advising for community college students pursuing the degree and ultimately a bachelor's degree. We are working closely with OUS to develop this new functionality for the community colleges, and OUS is actively participating in communications with the vendor and in implementation planning with the community colleges. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
And if I may briefly just add, this work is continuing. We, Krista and I both are staff to two groups that are continuing the work, the Unified Education Enterprise, the UEE, which has board members from each of the boards, the Board of Ed and the Board of Higher Ed, and also the Joint Boards Articulation Committee, and we have an annual work plan, and we are constantly working on this. And I heard Representative Wisnant's words loud and clear that the intention is to keep the attention on this, and we feel that we are, and if there's more, let us know, and we'll get on that as well. So thank you for this opportunity.
Great. Thank you very much, Joe. And you know, I would just say that, as I mentioned earlier, we have another bill that we're working on, and it may well be that the two bills can be married. And so I'm at some point probably going to want to invite you to have a sit down and let's look at these bills and see which, you know, really help, what elements of them can help us move forward as a state.
We look forward to that. Thank you.
Great. Questions of these panelists?
No questions?
I'm sure we do, but we'll ask Connie.
She's on
there. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
thanks.
Yeah,
well done.
The H thing.
Okay, I'd call up Connie Green, please.
Representative Dembro, members of the committee, I'm Connie Green. I am Vice President of Tillamook Bay Community College, soon to be President, and I'm here representing the Oregon Community College Associations. In the past, as for the past 5-7 years, I would have been here with this previous team because part of my role was staffing and helping with policy work for all the work between our systems, between community colleges and OUS. So it was fun listening to the work that we had done. We believe, as we've looked at this, the attention to the issue is really the next piece of this. So whether it's the bill before you or the bill that is coming that you refer to, Chair Dembro, how we go about our check nation transfer is the next piece. We've done great bookends. We've got great pieces in place. How do we continue to lift this to make it easier for students? WICHE, Western Interstate, you all know WICHE, okay? Commission on Higher Ed, okay. Let's make sure I can use an acronym and all in one stop, all of you. They did a study, and they looked around the nation at articulation and transfer. And when they did the study, they kind of looked at core components, all 50 states. And Oregon has a lot of great things in place. We have a general education core that Karen Sprague talked to. We have that in place. We don't have common course numbering, but we have this Atlas system that lets you do the equivalency, so you don't need to keep the courses all aligned when they... So that is positive. We have some block credit transfer, and we have the transfer and associate's degree, the AOT. The one column we don't have, the one area that we didn't have, was a statewide major articulation system. We've got all the pieces but that last piece. And that's really what I think both this bill and I believe is in the legislative concept coming from Chair Dembro is addressing. How do we get the next piece, the final piece in place to make it possible for students? And so OCCA is very supportive of the intent. We know there's some details we have got to work out, whether it's the timing or how you tell us to do it, but we know it's the next piece to do together. And you have your joint boards that is willing to lift it. You've got colleges willing to lift it and universities. It's how do we go about doing it? So as we move forward, we just want to make sure that you know we're behind you, want to work with you, and want to work out the details. Currently, to make it work, community colleges have on their website have all the articulation agreements for every community college. Every year they update it. So it's an easy way. So if you pick a college, I happen to open up to Columbia Gorge, it tells you how you what they have to transfer to Chemeketa, mm-hmm. what goes to Clackamas, what goes to OIT, what goes to Oregon State. It's really nice, very clear, but this is one of the ways we help students because we don't have a complete system. So we have individual articulation agreements. If you were Brad Berta from OIT, he would tell you he manages 150 articulation agreements a year between 17 community colleges and others to keep things aligned. He does it for students. We need to keep working together how to make this a little bit easier so you don't have to be a Representative Lindsay and get it in writing and keep the slip of paper with you to the very end. So I think we're on the same path. That's where we want to go. The other piece of this, I think Representative Wisner talked about the Bologna process. Illumina actually has taken that process in Europe, had a group of people study it. Cliff Adelman has worked with them. He's a national researcher on education, the kind of PK through 20. Where do you drop out? How do you succeed? What are the levers that help people succeed? And came out just 2 weeks ago with kind of the United States view version of that. It's called the Degree Qualifications Profile. And the Oregon Community Colleges are talking to Lumen about signing on, potentially get the university system to join us about how do we do that work together. So the things you're bringing to the table are the, do we believe, are the right things in education? How do we get the right timeline and the right wording so we can do it together to make it sustainable?
Thank you, Connie. Questions for Ms. Green? I would just want to make the point that if you look at today's college students, it's increasingly rare to have a student graduate from the college that they began at. You know, just thinking of my own experience, you know, with students, so many students started at one OUS institution, found themselves transferring to another OUS institution, simultaneously attended the community college, because this phenomenon of students swirling, that is combining, simultaneously attending a community college and a university, is an increasing trend. And the challenges that they face are not just simply between the community college and the university. It's often between the universities. And so this is really a very multidimensional issue. And I think it is a great thing that we talk about it, because it's not only a question of access, but it's also a question of success and college completion. I think if we can just improve this a little bit, we can have dramatic improvements in our college completion in this state.
And Representative Dembrough, I think you're totally right on. One of the things that in Senate Bill 342 that happened was some broad concepts. One of the things you're talking about here is really, if I look at California, they have a kind of a student rights and responsibility for articulation. It didn't tell people how to do it. It just said, for a student, from a student view, these things should be in place. And we may really want to look at some of those kinds of things that put the qualities, the characteristics, so that you, in the sorting environment, certain things happen to you versus being done to you. You can expect certain things to be done for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Connie. And with that, I'm going to close this informational hearing. There was a public hearing, that's right. But there was so much information. thank you. A public hearing on House Bill 2866. Thank you. Colleagues, that does it for this week. On Tuesday, we're going to have a hearing on dual credit and accelerated learning opportunities and partnerships between high schools and higher ed, and a number of other issues. So with that, I'll end this February 24th hearing of the Higher Ed Subcommittee.